You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. COVID-19 has touched all of our lives, but some communities are especially impacted. To learn about efforts to protect those of us who are most at risk, I spoke with Lisa Blecker, Pesticide Safety Education Program Coordinator for the UC Division of Agriculture and Natural Resources, Laura Moreno, Chair of the Fresno Madera Continuum of Care, and Kristen Beal Watson, CEO of the Kern Community Foundation. So, Kristen, I'd like to start with you. The Kern County COVID-19 Relief Fund was created by the Kern Community Foundation to support the region's most vulnerable residents. What are the populations being served by the fund?
So that's a good question. It's actually a pretty wide variety. As you can imagine, vulnerable populations encompasses a lot. So we're looking at isolated rural communities, whether they're north of us, in Delano, McFarland, those areas, or even to the south of us up into Fraser Park. But communities who really don't have the resources that maybe we see in the larger metropolitan areas. Additionally, we're serving seniors, obviously homeless, socioeconomically disadvantaged children, veterans, ag workers. The list just goes on and on.
It certainly does. There are so many people that are impacted right now. And you did mention the homeless population. I'd like to expand a bit more on that. Laura Moreno, you're with the Fresno Madera Continuum of Care. Can you give us an update on the work being done to provide housing for people who are experiencing homelessness at this time?
Yes. And so let me start by saying that the state of California took a very proactive approach to protecting our vulnerable homeless population against COVID-19. So early on, a couple of the departments at the state started looking at how do we bring people inside quickly, because they knew that folks out on the street were already vulnerable. They're already in those high-risk categories for COVID-19. And so how do we bring them in? One, to protect them, and two, to prevent the spread. Because of the way that people are forced to live when they're outside, they're much more vulnerable, and the spread could potentially be worse in those situations. So the state contacted all of the jurisdictions, and particularly through the continuums of care, and started laying out some plans, and so as well provided funding through a mechanism that had already been developed the year or two before. And so thankfully, the two governors previous started putting money into homelessness, and so processes were already set up. And last year, the jurisdiction was able to bring online over 100 new beds targeting homeless, and not just emergency shelter beds, but they were triage shelters aimed at getting people housed, and so wrapped them with a variety of services. So the structure was already in place, and so we have been able, with partnership with the state and with funding, been able to add an additional almost 300 beds in the last month. And it was an amazing process that this jurisdiction, Fresno and Madera areas, were able to pull together with private providers, and we were able to add 300 beds in a matter of just a few days. It was absolutely less than a week that we were able to add those. And so we have added overall about 400 or so beds, and that is really just to bring people inside. We need to bring our vulnerable populations inside. We looked at the most vulnerable first, which was over the age of 65 and those that had underlying health conditions. We needed to make sure that we got those folks inside. Outreach teams from various agencies were involved, and they went in and brought those people in. And then we opened it up to everyone else and have brought in over 400 people. To at least the very first step of it was just getting people inside, sheltering in place inside, and ensuring that those shelters are safe, that staff are safe, that clients are safe, and then looking at our existing shelters as well, those that were not just created with this pandemic, but were opened last year, and how we keep people safe there as well.
So do you have a sense at this point of how many people in Fresno and Madera counties are still without shelter?
So if we look at the point in time count that was conducted in 2019, so every year this Fresno Madera Continuum of Care has conducted a point-in-time count. It's been probably the last 5 or 6 years we've been doing it every year. HUD requires that we do it every other year, but we felt like it was very valuable information and necessary, and it has proven to be very helpful. So in the 2019 PIT count, we did a 2021, but the numbers haven't been released yet. In 2019, just in Fresno and Madera counties, there were 2,069 people that were unsheltered homeless. In the city of Fresno, there were 935. So we've added, like I said, almost 400 beds. So if we just do the math, we figure that there's still over 500 people that are unsheltered at this point. Now, other programs have privately sheltered as well. The Fresno Rescue Mission has been really great about sheltering. So I would say there's probably 450 to 550 people that are still unsheltered just in Metro Fresno. When we look at Fresno County, there were 543 unsheltered, and we haven't added any beds there yet. We're looking at adding 80 beds in the outlying rural areas. So even once we add the 80 beds, we're still going to have approximately 450 people that are unsheltered if we're using the 2019 PIT number. So there's still quite a few people that are left out on the street.
And still lots of work to do to help them out. Well, thank you for that update. I'd like to shift the conversation over to Lisa. Can you speak to the importance of PPE for ag workers? Obviously, to protect them for COVID-19, but for other reasons as well. Just fill us in on why it's so important.
Personal protective equipment, or we call it PPE for short, is essential for people that handle pesticides. And so people who handle pesticides do things like they mix or they load pesticides, and of course they apply pesticides. And PPE is a key layer of protection between pesticides and their bodies. So it protects them from pesticide exposure through one or more of the four routes of exposure. So pesticides can enter your body through eyes, nose, mouth, and skin, and there's PPE to protect through all of those routes. And it helps to prevent both acute and chronic long-term exposure to pesticides. And different pesticides have the potential to harm you in different ways. So the PPE that you wear for one pesticide may be slightly different than the PPE that you wear for another pesticide. So our pesticide handlers are doing, you know, critical ag work out there for us, and they're also doing a potentially harmful job or dangerous job. So it's important that they're protected on a daily basis when they're out there handling pesticides.
And do they have access to the PPE that they need?
Well, I think I don't have firsthand knowledge of whether or not all of the handlers or applicators out there have access to all the PPE that they need, but I know that there is a PPE shortage. So the PPE that is critical for healthcare workers is some of the exact same PPE that pesticide workers also use. So an N95 mask, those are not easy to find at the moment. And sometimes the Tyvek brand coveralls are often sold out, and some of the disposable gloves are also often sold out. So it may be more difficult to find PPE, or they may need to identify alternative PPE, but it is essential that they wear PPE or find another pesticide that doesn't require the PPE that they can't find.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We are talking about how COVID-19 is impacting some of the Valley's most vulnerable communities. Kristen, with the Kern Community Foundation, I'd like to turn the conversation back to you. You know, when we talked about the COVID-19 relief fund that your foundation created to protect and support vulnerable residents, you listed a variety of communities that are being deeply impacted. And I'm just wondering, in these difficult times when so many communities are struggling, how do you determine where to allocate your resources?
You know, that's a really, really good question. And I have to tell you, it is incredibly challenging. So we stood this fund up the 16th of March and announced it to the public. And I'm happy to say, you know, originally my thought was we did not need to start a fund. We needed to just direct donations to the nonprofits who are serving vulnerable populations. There was no reason for us to get in the way. But then after talking to several of our business leaders in town, they said, you know what, we are swamped with the fires that we're putting out in our own businesses, and yet we still want to be philanthropically minded. So would you please open a fund so that we can contribute, do our duty philanthropically, and use your grant-making capacity? So happy to say we did that, and to date, we have $450,000 that has come into the fund. That said, we have received a total of 130 grant applications, and the grant process is incredibly abbreviated and expedited because we did not want it to be onerous. And it is a grant that's available to any nonprofit or school or church that's serving in Kern County, and we did have a small pot of money that actually went into Tulare County as well. So we had 129 applications totaling $1.5 million in requests. So you can see we're a little bit short, right? And so our primary focus from day one in this first, what we call tranche of funding, is basic needs. What organizations need those resources that are directly going to go out, provide food, shelter, safety for vulnerable populations? And that has been predominantly where funds have gone out. So people like the Salvation Army, who are providing rental assistance, utility assistance, our homeless shelters, Alliance Against Family Violence, who obviously, in difficult times like this, they need support because they see an increase in casework. An organization in East Kern called Bags for Kids that provide resources where families in need can come by and get those resources that they need, whether they're diapers or formula or just sustainable foods for their families. So it's been a wide variety, but we really have intentionally said, how can we provide support in terms of food, shelter, and safety?
So that's obviously addressing the short-term needs, which are significant, but there's going to be a long-term need in terms of the economic impact, even after we get past this pandemic. Have you even had a chance to think about what your strategy might be in the long-term, or right now is your energy really just focused on those immediate pressing needs that the community has?
So that, you know what, that's what keeps me up at night, because while our day-to-day operations are focused on just getting funds and resources out as quickly as we can to those organizations that need it the most, I do realize that, and I mentioned that's the first tranche. So the second tranche to me is, how do we continue to support an expanding population, which I believe it's going to be an expanding population of vulnerable folks. And then also linked very closely with that is, how do we stand up and support the nonprofit organizations who have been hit hard by this pandemic? They've lost program funding. They've lost fundraising events. They've lost a variety of things. And so while there are resources, and we try as best we can to link them to whether it's payroll protection, whether it's emergency loan funding, whether it's just some basic technology needs, I believe that the real work is going to come in that second tranche. And I'm happy to say that we are regularly engaged with the other community foundations serving the Central Valley. So Central Valley Community Foundation, Stanislaus Community Foundation, and San Joaquin Community Foundation, and really trying to figure out how we can bring more resources to the Central Valley, because unfortunately, if you look at the state of California, resources just don't philanthropic resources do not come to this area at the same levels that they go to the metropolitan areas, the Bay Area and Southern California. So if our thinking is if we can band together and if we can really think strategically about how to support the nonprofit organizations and how to think, what's that long play for really making a difference in hitting those really critical areas. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Without a doubt. You're listening to Valley Edition. Today, we're talking about the impact of COVID-19 on the Valley's most vulnerable communities. Before the break, we were talking about how organizations are finding the balance between addressing the short-term and the long-term needs of people who are suffering right now. And I'd like to hear now from Laura Moreno, a chair of the Fresno Madera Continuum of Care. Given the amount of job loss we have seen and continue to see, what impact do you think that will have in the long term on homeless rates?
So I definitely think that this is going to have an impact on what we see on the street. And so when you have high rates of unemployment, when you have people that can't pay their rent, one of the things that concerns me, and I was having a conversation with an organization about this, is the whole issue around the rent forgiveness for the time being. So the moratorium on evictions, and if somebody can't pay their rent, then the landlord can't kick them out, which is a great idea in concept. But if somebody is just barely making their rent and it's, say, $800 or $900 a month, and so they've lost their job and maybe they're not paying their rent, then 3 months from now, when this is slowed down and they're back to work, they're at the point where they owe $2,700. And so if somebody was struggling with the $800 or $900 monthly rent, having to come up with $2,700 is going to be a whole lot tougher. So I think that we're going to see a whole lot of different issues that pop up, whether it's specifically those homeless that are on the street or whether we see an uptick because of the moratorium on evictions, but then it comes into play in month 3, 4, 5, or 6. We're going to have to do something a little bit different. And so as the continuum of care and the partners are looking at how we ramp up, you know, quickly to add more beds and bring more people inside, we need to start planning for what happens at the end of this. When COVID has eased up some, we have added 400 people into shelters. How do we then help them transition from a shelter into something more permanent? And so if we see an increase in people on the street because of loss of jobs and reduced income and businesses closing, we're going to have 400 to 500 people that are we just going to open the door and say, okay, COVID's over, so you know we're going to close these shelters now because the money was temporary, and we release them on the street again? Or how do we start planning for something a little more long-term and how we move people into something more permanent? So that's something that we're having to look at right now in the midst of COVID. How do we plan for the lessening of this, and how do we move people into something more permanent and not just release them onto the street again? So I think that it's twofold. It's the increases because of the loss of jobs, the loss of employment, the closing of businesses, and also all the people that we brought inside. How do we transition them, and where do we find the money to transition them? Because the money that's coming in right now is it's immediate and it's an emergency situation. It's not really meant for long term.
Absolutely. Let's turn back to Lisa Blecker and our conversation we were having earlier about the shortage of PPE for ag workers who are dealing with pesticides. What advice do you have for ag workers who are applying pesticides and may not have access to the PPE that they need?
Well, thank you for that question. That is a question that I deal with in my daily job, even when we are not in the midst of this COVID-19 crisis. You know, it is always important to follow the pesticide label and California regulations for using the correct PPE. There is a reason why PPE is required by the label and regulations. It's to prevent, you know, the acute hazards, but also the long-term exposure to pesticides. California regulations are often more stringent than label directions. So for handlers applying pesticides, They need to know what the California regulations require in addition to what the pesticide label says. So in California, most of our employees that are handling pesticides have to wear chemical-resistant gloves and protection for their eyes, even if the label doesn't require them. And it's not okay to handle pesticides without the adequate PPE. So all of our pesticide handlers, whether they have a qualified applicator certification or if they're licensed or if they're trained annually as a handler, they should all understand before handling any pesticide at all how PPE protects them and what PPE is required. So we have extensive training requirements. And so if a handler can't find the correct PPE that's identified by both the pesticide label and California regulations, they need to seek help from their employer in identifying a solution. One solution could be to find replacement PPE that is at least as protective or potentially more protective, or they can work with their employer to identify other pesticides that could be used that don't require as much PPE or that don't require the PPE that they cannot identify, that they can't find. One thing I've been telling people is to use reusable PPE when possible. You know, our healthcare workers are more likely to use disposable gloves and disposable coveralls, whereas in agriculture and other industries where we apply pesticides, a tightly woven cotton coverall that completely covers the arms, torso, and legs is an acceptable substitute for these disposable coveralls. So using reusable PPE really reduces the demand on the PPE supply. And so they can be washed, those cotton coveralls can be washed and reworn multiple times. Most people are going to be wearing a minimum of long sleeve shirt, long pants, socks, closed toed shoes, some chemical resistant glove, and protection for their eyes. Sometimes our pesticide handlers need to wear a respirator. And it's important to pay attention to what the label is requiring of your respirator, because respirators can protect you from two different types of contaminants, either a particulate or a vapor. And so whatever your label is telling you you need protection from, it's really important to know that when you're identifying something, an alternative. So for example, the N95 respirators that healthcare workers use and are critical for them right now, our ag workers are not going to be able to find them as easily, but if they have a reusable elastomeric respirator mask that they can add a particulate filter to, that's a good alternative for them.
There are options, right? But I'm just wondering if this situation might cause some farmers to step back from their use of pesticides and then whether or not this could have some impact on the food supply chain.
You know, I think the impact on the food supply chain is really unclear. There are so many forces exerting pressure on the food supply chain at the moment, COVID being one of them and causing many of those pressures. I don't know if PPE directly will impact the food supply chain. I think it has the potential to impact business operations because if people can't find the correct PPE for their workers, then they have to make this really tough choice of not applying that pesticide. And what does that mean? That they don't apply any pesticide at all? Or do they identify a pesticide that, for example, doesn't require an N95 respirator? And maybe that pesticide isn't as efficacious, or then that requires additional training for their applicators, because we train our handlers and applicators on every individual pesticide that they're handling.
I'd like to come back to Kristen and talk quickly about education. What role do you see the Kern Community Foundation playing to minimize the impact of school closures on educational attainment?
We continue to do what we can to support our educators. We envision that once there's some normalcy back, that our districts, the 47 districts that exist in Kern, and that's 47 K-12 districts, they'll all come back together and we will discuss lessons learned and what can be changed going forward. They all have a agreed to and operate under what's called the Current Education Pledge. And so we will get back to focusing on that. Right now, it's all about how to best serve the students in these uncertain times and these extenuating circumstances. From a just real boots on the ground piece, you know, we are a large scholarship provider in Kern County. Over the last 4 years, have generated over $2 million in scholarships to 1,100 students. And I'm happy to say that because of the platform that we use and the technology that is available to us, that application program is still continuing. In fact, we're in the midst of evaluating some 500 applications that have been submitted by graduating seniors. Things are going to look a little bit different. You know, transcripts are going to look a little bit different. But our role is really to make sure that we help to filter the information and lower that stress level for our students. So many of our students are first generation college going, and we want to make sure that they don't become unhinged in these uncertain times and wash away that long-term goal of a post-secondary experience. My fear is that we'll have students who say, never mind, I'm going to stay home and not go to college. And so we just do what we can to support and to be that extra safety net for students. We will be generating almost $300,000 in scholarships this year. And things are, again, they're going to look a little bit different. We don't have those award nights and those celebrations, but instead, you know, we can do different things and do our best. Our team is working on how to create a celebratory environment using social distancing protocols. So look for more to come on that. But education is still plays a critical role in the work that we do. And this, yes, may seem like a misstep and maybe even possibly that we're moving backwards, but actually I think it's a true opportunity for us. I think our educators are doing a phenomenal job with providing learning opportunities, whether it's distance or any variety. They're being very, very creative. But I think at the end of the day, when this we've moved past the social distancing and are back to some level of normalcy, we'll be able to use the information and the experiences that have been revealed to really explore where are our weaknesses and where are our strengths and what can we do to improve them.
Certainly. It's a silver lining amidst all of this. You know, we just have a minute or two before we need to wrap up, and I'd like to give Laura Moreno the last word. You spoke earlier about the increase in capacity in Fresno and Madera County to house people who are experiencing homelessness. Can you speak to what is happening at shelters to prevent the spread of COVID-19?
Yes, absolutely. This is a really important component of our plan as well. So it was not only bring online new shelter beds, but as well ensure that the shelters that we have are safe. We need staff to be safe, to feel safe. We need clients to be safe and to feel safe. And so we looked at what their needs were. The state has offered PPEs for our shelter providers as well, and so the Department of Behavioral Health has been instrumental in organizing that and distributing PPEs. We brought in disinfecting companies, so they come into the shelters once a week and they do a complete disinfecting so that, again, we're sure that our staff are safe and that we're sure that our clients are safe. We've also worked at, like, everybody had trouble finding toilet paper, so did shelters. And so the county partnered with all the shelters to ensure that they had access. So we were able to order toilet paper and some of the necessary supplies to keep the shelters functioning. So that was a really important piece as well. And it's been the partnership between the city, the county of Madera, the departments of behavioral health and departments of social services, as well as our continuum providers that have allowed us to truly keep our shelters, our existing shelters, safe. Keep them functioning, keeping the shelter in place for shelter residents as well, and ensuring that we have a workforce that feels safe and is able to come in, because that is frontline work that our shelter workers are doing. Our outreach team are doing frontline work as well and making sure that they have the supplies to clean their vans when they transport people from the street. They've also had to transport people from hospitals who are positive. And so making sure that they have all of the equipment they have has been one of the most important things that we've been working on.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing, the work that all of you are doing to protect our vulnerable communities. And thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.